Okay, today we're going to talk mostly about protein glycosylation and its manipulation, but I'm going to start out by finishing up our discussion of antibody structure and with some variations on that structure that are used in the biotech industry. So, making fusion proteins where you have your favorite protein is not a monoclonal antibody or any kind of antibody, but is some other kind of protein that's going to do some good. Most often, receptor domains of that bind targets of interest. If you attach them to the constant portion of an antibody molecule, then you confer many of the advantages the antibody molecule has, such as longer life in the bloodstream and stability and ability to cross epithelial barriers, some of the things we talked about last time. You can confer that on the business end, which instead of the variable region of the antibody is a receptor, for example. So the most widely used, molecule of that type that's used as a drug is etanercept or Enbrel, which is an anti-cancer, anti-lymphoma drug, and also an anti-inflammatory drug. So it has a receptor for the CD20, which is an antigen on B cells of a certain stage of differentiation, which gets locked in during some during the development of some lymphomas, and which is giving rise to cells that mediate inflammation in some pathological cases. So, sorry, not CD20. This is the tumor necrosis factor. So, by putting two of these TNF receptors onto the Fc domain, you also get the receptor dimerized, which increases its avidity for its target. So you can talk about affinity, which is sort of the intrinsic interaction between a ligand and the protein. You can measure a KD for that. But you can use the additional term and concept of avidity, in which you have more than one. You have a bivalent or trivalent or tetravalent protein and a series of ligands, so that even though the KD, which is dominating the binding ability, or the binding forces holding the ligand and the receptor together, are dissociated as part of the equilibrium. At one moment, there's another binding site on the same molecule that's at that moment still binding, and so you don't have dissociation of this multivalent molecule. So it's really avidity. You can increase avidity by making multivalent proteins. And the antibody itself, the natural antibody molecule, uses this by having two antigen receptors, antigen binding sites on every molecule. There was in development another drug which made a lot of sense, which was the CD4, which is one of two antigens on the surface of T cells that are necessary for HIV to make its entrance into those cells. So one is CCR5, and the other, and the first known one, was CD4, first cloned right here at Columbia by a postdoc in Richard Axel's lab many years ago, who went on to form a company based on this CD4, Progenix. And they're up in Tarrytown. So they took the soluble CD4. First, they tried the soluble CD4 itself. They thought the idea was just to flood the bloodstream with this CD4. It would act as a decoy for the virus, and the CD4, the virus would attach to the soluble CD4, and so it wouldn't be able to attach to the CD4 and the T cells. This did not work so well. So they tried now fusing it to an immunoglobulin G molecule, or a G2 molecule of a certain class of G. And so to each of the two arms of this antibody molecule, they attached, instead of having the V heavy and the V light, they actually attached two CD4 molecules. So they had four, all four V regions were replaced by this CD4. So they made like a light chain with a constant and a CD4, and a heavy chain with constant CD4. And then they assembled it into an antibody-looking molecule. So it seemed like a great idea. However, that also didn't work. Or I guess hasn't worked so well. About last year, they they decided to switch to the CCR5 cell surface target. It seems to be more amenable. Here they could choose the IgG2 instead of regular IgG because it actually has less of this Fc function that would mediate cell-mediated cytotoxicity. So that would be a side effect that they didn't want because they're targeting the virus, not cells in this case. So that was an intelligent choice also. And they showed it had a better half-life in the bloodstream than CD4 itself. But nevertheless, they've changed their target. More generally, and we're going to see more of this next time when we talk about sort of designer antibodies. Are variations on this theme of the natural Y-shaped tetrameric molecule, the most extreme being to make a single chain antibody, or SCFV. So it's just the variable regions, the two variable regions, the heavy chain and light chain, just one of each, just attached with an artificial linker that's long enough to allow them to interact the same way they would in a natural antibody molecule, it's thought anyway, and reconstitute an antigen binding site. So this is a much simpler molecule than this tetramer. It's just a monomer. It has, of course, the deficiency that it doesn't have that avidity advantage of being multivalent. On the other hand, it's easy to manipulate genetically, and as we'll talk about next time, making antibodies, making your own antibody library, single chain antibodies facilitate that and make it easier and are pretty widely used. You can go back and make a bivalent single chain antibody by taking two of these VH and VLs that are themselves link them to the light chain. This is C-kappa. If you can't read that, that's the light chain constant region, which themselves associate naturally through their disulfide bonds, and they still do that in this kind of chimeric molecule to give you two binding sites on one dimer. And so it's just by adding this extra CK domain, it isn't that much more complicated than the single chain antibody itself. So.
I have a question in the previous slide. So how does the formation, or how does making that single chain antibody, the part C, how does it affect the specificity of the molecule?
Well, I can't cite you the example, but I'm just arguing back from the existence of this C on this diagram that it works, and that it didn't have to be drawn this way. For instance, it could have been drawn with these two arms of the VL and VH sticking up in the air to look more like the antibody, which maybe would allay your fear a little bit, but basically they still do work because these domains that are naturally together in the natural antibodies still fold into their proper form for antigen binding. So whatever the specificity, if you took this from the VH and VL from a natural antibody and constructed a single chain antibody like this, it would maintain its antigen binding activity, or at least often enough so that people do this. So let's say you made a whole bunch of these single chain antibodies, and you can think of doing it various ways. Again, this is a topic we'll go into much more deeply next time. But just to finish off this section on antibodies, if you you could think of two extremes and everything in between. One, you could take the variable in light chains from a person and make a library out of that person's own library that that person has made throughout her life for an exposure to antigens, or a person that's reacting against some pathogen, and just clone all the cDNAs from the mRNAs that are coding for all the variable light chains and all the variable heavy chains, all with all their hypermutations in them, and make this giant library, and then screen it for the activity that you want. Let's say its ability to bind GP120, which is a surface antigen on HIV, let's say. You thought maybe that might be useful. It would be useful, at worst, it would be useful as a diagnostic, right? So, but how do you screen for such a thing? So the most popular screening method is something called phage display. It takes advantage of an E. coli bacteriophage, one or more different. M13 is probably the most popular. There are others called FD and F1. These viruses are single-stranded DNA viruses. But the important thing is they have about, as you see here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, maybe 5 different, or maybe 8. I see the Roman numerals go up to 8 here. A small number of proteins that form the capsid of this virus. And some are displayed on the outside quite prominently. It turns out with a couple of these proteins, you can make fusion proteins. In this case, P3, which is a popular one you see is sticking out like a tail at the end. You can take your POI, protein of interest, and make a gene for this P3 protein that's a fusion gene, and it will still get incorporated if you do it right, and you still get most of the P3 present here, and it incorporates as part of the virus, and it's displayed on the outside of the virus. Thus, the virus is a bacteriophage, so it's called phage display. And P7, I think, is another target you can use. So what's nice about the viruses is that you can grow them in E. coli. So if we start at the top here, let's say you have all your cDNA library from your source of human antibodies, from a person, let's say, and now you put them into a vector that has this P3 gene, and the rest of the genes of the virus, or you might infect an E. coli cell that has some of these genes naturally expressing and incorporated earlier, like a helper, as we saw in the case of the packaging systems and mammalian cells for retrovirus vectors. So the result is that all your cDNAs will now make fusion proteins, and each phage will display one of those proteins, depending on what DNA molecule it got in as its genetic material, as its little chromosome here. So you infect E. coli, the virus grows, the virus lyses the E. coli cells and comes out. And if you do it at a low multiplicity of infection, each E. coli just gets one virus. And so that burst of virus all contain the gene for the cDNA-based gene for that antibody B region and the chimeric protein that's produced by that gene. So that if you expose these viruses now to the antigen you're interested in, immobilized on the bottom of a dish, which is called panning, or on a bead, you just shake them up with the beads, then the phage that have that protein will bind preferentially to those beads, and the others will bind maybe non-specifically. There'll be always some noise, but most of them will not bind, and so you can centrifuge these or filter them, collect the viruses, wash them as much as you dare, and then elute the essentially to elute the phage. This is the intact phage from the beads or the surface of the dish, and then take these phage, which are still infectious phage, and infect a new culture of E. coli. And so just drop it in to a shaken culture in solution. It will infect the cells. The cells will again burst, lyse, and will now give a population of phage that's highly enriched in the guise that bound to the beads. And you can continue this cycle several times until you have essentially all phage which are able to bind this antigen. Meanwhile, at each step, because you're afraid something bad might happen, you can withdraw some at each step, freeze the phage away, so you can always go back to them. You can see how many phage you have by titrating them. And the way you do that is if you plate an agar dish and then you plate a million E. coli in that dish, the E. coli will grow into a lawn. And then if you put phage onto that lawn from a diluted stock, wherever a phage hits, times the probability that it will initiate an actual infection, which is not 100%. But you can get an infection of one of those E. coli on the lawn. That E. coli, after a few hours, will burst and release a whole bunch of phage. And those will now infect the E. coli that are sitting right next to it, et cetera, et cetera. And so you end up with plaques, which are clear areas where there are no E. coli, only lyse E. coli cells inside these plaques. And the plaques are just teeming with bacteriophage, of course, that have been released. So now you can go in and pick individual phage populations from each plaque. They're essentially cloned for you. So all this is without any PCR or anything. Right? So you have your... you can now grow up these phage in a tube of E. coli, spin out the E. coli, take the phage, and extract the DNA from the phage, and you have your cloned molecules. So you can screen this way very large numbers of molecules, 10 to the 10th molecules, maybe 10 to the 11th molecules. I'm not sure what the present numbers are, but certainly 10 to the 10th, which is a lot of different combinations. This trick, you have... We're going to be talking a lot about genetic selections for molecules that would be useful. Usually selected on the basis of affinity for something. So we have so many tools for manipulating nucleic acids, cloning them, PCRing them, amplifying them, expressing them. What we need to do, on the other hand, the actual work of life is carried out by the proteins that are the expressed products of these genes. And that's what we have to screen for. That's the phenotype, ability to bind GT120 in the example we were using. So any kind of screening mechanism, the problem is, how do you connect the genotype from the phenotype? You get the guy that's binding. If it didn't have that phage carrying it, it was just the protein, yes, you know you have it. But you don't know what gene made it. You could try, I guess, to sequence the protein, but nobody does that anymore. It's just too hard, right, compared to sequencing DNA. Right? So connecting genotype that you're selecting for with the genotype that produced that phenotype is always the question. And phage display is a very powerful way, because in one test tube, essentially, you can screen 10 to the 10th different molecules. And we'll talk about ways that are even more powerful next time. Okay, so now let's talk for the rest of the time about protein glycosylation. This is kind of an odd subject. Usually, I guess, ends up in cell biology classes. I get a feeling that it's not really covered very well. Maybe biochemistry classes. So I'll go into some biochemical details. There'll be a lot of background as well, as and finish off with how it's manipulated in the service of biotechnology companies. So proteins that are secreted, almost all of them are glycosylated one way or the other, and a lot of the proteins on the surface of cells, whether it's are also glycosylated. That is, sugar groups are added to the protein. So we know that proteins are modified in many ways. Phosphorylation, of course, is very popular as a way of regulating the activity of enzymatic proteins and signaling proteins. But there are other modifications, like adding of lipids to anchor proteins to the membrane, methylation of amino acids to control the structure of the protein and its activities. Adding sugars is in a way the most complex and sophisticated, I think you might say, post-translational modification, because the structures that are produced are pretty big and they're varied and they're complex. So and they're used for different things. You can modify the actual function of the protein. It'll be more active or only active when you have this carbohydrate groups on the outside. Often they extend the lifetime of a protein in the bloodstream. They can also decrease the lifetime of protein in the bloodstream. And so make sure that it doesn't accumulate. That might be good for a natural situation. The protein gets localized within the cell. There's an increasing number of nuclear proteins that are found to be glycosylated, and was thought to be only secreted proteins, but now it's just mostly secreted proteins. And as it's displayed on the surface of a cell as a cell surface protein, the carbohydrate groups can act as specific antigens that allow you to recognize the certain kinds of cells that are producing that certain kind of carbohydrate modification. Yes?
Just like a question. Is there any phenotype that can give, if there is any problem with the glycosylation, can this lead to phenotype?
It can, yes. So the question is, are there phenotypic associations associated with changes in glycosylation? We'll talk about some of those in a minute. I think the blood group blood group antigens are certainly, but they're sort of diagnostic. I don't know if they have any functional role other than telling you how compatible you will be for a transfusion. So let's look at what they look like chemically. They can be divided into two types depending on what amino acid they're attached to. The so-called N-linked, which is attached to the, in blue here, the nitrogen at the end of the amide group at the end of the side chain of asparagine. Right? So that's C double bond O NH, it's uncharged. And you attach this sugar to it. In this case, it's an N-linked GLC, which stands for glucose, and NAC, which stands for N-acetyl. So there's been two modifications of this sugar. There's a glucose ring here, which we'll talk about. I'll remind you about in a minute more. And then this has a substitution of one of its hydroxyl groups with an amino group first. That made it glucosamine. And then this acetyl group has made an amide bond with this amino group to make it N-acetyl amino glucose, or glucosamine. The O-linked is the other form, and that's on serine or threonine or sometimes tyrosine. So these are the side chains that have hydroxyl groups. So there's the OH group that's now been used to make this bond. It's more like a to the sugars OH. And here we have N-acetyl galactose. N-acetyl-galactose. So the difference between galactose and glucose, I'll show you again in a minute, is they are isomers with just a different position of the OH group on the sugar ring. So here's our review of sugar structure, of hexose structure in particular. Here's the single chain. I have these review, a blue background on these review graphics. Number 8. So the straight chain is in equilibrium and is mostly in the form of a ring where the C1 and the C5 connect to form a ring that has an oxygen at one vertex here and five members otherwise for a total six-membered ring. It's a six-carbon sugar, so there's one carbon left over, which is carbon six, and that hangs off on one side. Now, when you form this, you attack this C double bond O double bond here, this aldehyde at the top of glucose, by this carbon 5 hydroxyl, it can attack either on one side or the other side of the carbon oxygen bond, and that in the ring makes a difference as to the new hydroxyl that's formed here at carbon 1. See, this carbon 5 oxygen is going to end up as part of the ring. I know it's a little hard to follow, but you can sort of stare at it afterwards. And so you have actually two different configurations in space. These are two different stereoisomers of glucose that form from the single chain, either alpha, in which case the OH is below the H, and or beta, in which the OH is above the H. This doesn't give the real three-dimensional structure, this standard, what's called the Haworth view, but rather the ring is puckered and looks like this, and but doesn't need to concern us too much, other than its three-dimensional structure, which determines everything in biology, and so these two are quite different in the way they are configured in space. This carbon is called the anomeric carbon, the one that can initiate the ring formation that's attacked, and this anomeric carbon hydroxyl then can exist in two states. So altogether, glucose in a water solution is in three states, the straight chain, a minority, and roughly equal amounts of the alpha and beta form hydroxyl in different position. Actually looks quite like a compact molecule. There's nothing inside. All the electrons fill up this ring, so it's quite a compact molecule in the ring. So I have a little animated it's only going to work from here, I guess. So this is a sort of a semi-animation of this straight chain now dancing around, finally finding itself with the two ends approaching each other, and the C5 and the C1 are actually positioned just right, so that when those this OH and this OH just collide, they are forming a nice strain-free ring. It could form a five-membered ring, but six is preferable. And then we get that connection. So we have it here in color. It's coming in from the left, you notice here, with its red H. And that results in it going to the top. If it came in from the top or the right, then the OH would be in the bottom. Right? One way or the other way. In nature, this makes a big difference. For instance, you make a polymer now with these beta linkages, for example, you get kind of a linear structure where you're going from one end of the molecule, 1 to 4 to 1 to 4 to 1 to 4, in a pretty straight chain, and you end up forming cellulose. But if you have this alpha glucose instead that has this OH sticking down, in this case. Here it's sticking out, actually, not up. Right? So it can form this long straight molecule, which then can associate with other straight molecules to form a cellulose fiber and a shirt. Maltose, on the other hand, makes a turn, and the next one's going to make another turn and another turn, and it's going to form kind of a wide helix and a compact structure, which is starch. So it has completely different, the same glucose, is depending on, you know, whether it's alpha or beta, used for two completely different things. One, a structural stalk of a flower, or strength in a leaf, and in the other case, a storage form of glucose in the muscle or in your liver as glycogen in animals or starch in plants. Okay, so now let's get back to the glycoproteins. Here's some of the common. There's a couple more complicated ones that will appear in the bottom of this graphic 12. There's glucose, there's mannose, galactose, and I would point out to these three, these are all actually also just stereoisomers of each other. So they're all like stereoisomers of glucose, let's say. But they're given different English names just for historical regions. The only difference between glucose and mannose is that in glucose, this hydroxyl on carbon 2, there's 6 sticking out, 5, 4, 3, 2. Whereas it's below the hydrogen, in this case, I hesitate to say it's down or up because you have to really put it into its chair form to know what it looks like in three-dimensional space. But here the OH is certainly below the hydrogen, and here it's above the hydrogen. So actually it's sticking out here and sticking up here in mannose. And galactose, the same thing, except it's on carbon 4. The hydroxyl is reversed compared to glucose. Fucose, on the other hand, has a bigger change. It's not an isomer. It's got a CH3 group here instead of CH2OH. And many of the sugars that are added to proteins have this N-acetyl group substituted for one or more of the hydroxyls. So you often see this N-acetyl. And one of them is really quite complicated. This is called sialic acid. It's synonymous with neuraminic acid. That should be neuraminic. Or N-acetylneuraminic acid, or NaNa. It has a number of modifications. Maybe the most extreme is that it's an acid. You see this, there's a carboxyl group here in addition to the OH. Over here there's this R on carbon 5 instead of having this carbon 6, and that's a complete glycerol molecule with three more carbons over here. Here's an N-acetyl group, and here's a deoxy. So this is highly modified and quite common on especially secreted and cell surface glycoproteins. Now, it's kind of interesting the way for N-linked, the ones that go on the asparagine, these are by far more complex than the O-linked carbohydrate groups. And they're actually made ahead of time, separately, and then as a group, as this branched group. And the sugars themselves are almost always carried by nucleotides, like UDP, glucosamine, say, and then UDP, mannose, etc. And there's this polyalcohol, not completely showing up here, called dulcitol, which is a carrier for the whole business. So it's got three hydroxyls and about six carbons. And it's phosphorylated, and that's where you start with. And then you add one sugar, and then you add another sugar, and then you make a branch and start putting sugars on the two branches. So it's quite a number of steps, as you see here. Why it's done this way and not put on right on the protein, I don't know. Now I need this is a wonderful combination presenter and pointer, but it eats batteries. Get through one lecture. One and a half. Okay. So finally, look at this guy. It's got 1, 2, 3 antennae, and it's called, this would be in fact called a triantennary sugar. And that, at this point, it's transferred to the protein, indicated by this scrambled line, and sticks onto the protein. Then some of these glucose molecules can be shaved off, and so you have further modifications that take place. Let's look at some of these in a little more detail. So here's one that's got a trunk of glucosamine, N-acetylglucosamine, N-acetylglucosamine mannose, and then it bifurcates into two more mannoses. And then these grow into more mannoses and another bifurcation. So that's this, and it's shown here schematically. Whereas this guy's a little different. So it's got a stem, again, with two N-acetylglucosamines, but this has a fucose sticking off the side of this trunk. And then at the bifurcation, in addition to the two mannoses here, this mannose makes altogether four, connected to four other sugars, including this N-acetylglucosamine, which has a special name, we'll see in a minute. And otherwise, just two antenna. You can look at it this way. Here's a protein with its with this sugar attached to it. And you can see the sugar is actually quite a big structure compared to the protein. It's not like just one little phosphate group. You can go as far as four antennae. Here's a bisecting N-acetylglucosamine over here. And the fucosylated core is over here. That's there, there. All of these are unendling groups and still losing it. And the asparagine is usually next to a serine or a threonine with one other amino acid, which can be anything except proline, in between. But the actual determination of which asparagine, of the many asparagines in a protein, are going to be glycosylated is not clear and is more complex. I said that. Yeah. So obviously they're attached to the outside for one thing, because they can't. This transferase is not going to be able to get inside the protein to transfer this prefabricated essentially complex carbohydrate, or near the termini. They're often found near the termini of the protein for the same reason of accessibility. This is just a blow up of that first case. The O-linked oligosaccharides, on the other hand, are quite a bit simpler. Just two, three, or four sugars, but often they have that complex sugar sialic acid. And here, unlike the prefabricated case for the N-linked glycosylation, they are put onto the protein one at a time. So the different structures can be indicative or determined by what type of cell you're in. It's not clear, really, to me anyway, how this is happening. Even the same kind of cell in different physiological states will produce different population of carbohydrate molecules on a given protein. That where and how often the sites are used is determined by the three-dimensional structure of the protein. And as an example of this perplexing specificity, transferrin, which is a protein that brings iron into the cell, if you look at it as it's made in the brain and detected in the cerebrospinal fluid, it has all these adjectives. It's diantennary. It's asialo, which means it doesn't have a sialic group on it. It's agalacto. It's fucosylated, and it has this bisecting N-acetylglucosamine. If you look at that same transferrin in the blood, it's diantennary again, but now it is sialated, and it's afucosylated. So it doesn't have it. So they just add the sialic acid and take away the fucose, or it's made that way in the blood compared to the cerebrospinal fluid. So there's a targeting role for these glycoproteins, clearance rate I've already talked about. And you shouldn't get the idea maybe that you have one particular kind of carbohydrate on this protein and it's that's the structure. It's more complicated yet, because a given protein in a given cell that's making it can have a variety of carbohydrate groups and structures on it. So we'll have mostly one thing with a lot of something else, a lot of something else, and a little of something else yet. So that's what's called microheterogeneity, lots of isoforms present. There's a little bit conflicting data on this, as we'll see. You might think that with all this enzymatic machinery that's necessary to get these groups on, that if you overproduce your protein, as we talked about, by gene amplification or whatever mechanism, strong promoters, and it's going to be glycosylated, could you be saturating the machinery necessary for the glycosylation of that protein if it's a certain kind of glycosylation? That doesn't seem to be the case, because you take a protein that's made normally out of some small amount, and you make it now 100 times or 1,000 times more. Well, this is probably an exaggeration. Certainly 100 times more. The molecules are glycosylated properly. So that's good in terms of the industry. Mammalian cells are used for this, mainly mouse and hamster, because insect cells, although they have the convenience of giving you in transient transfection a high level of the protein, they're used in research laboratories a lot. Several laboratories in our department use the baculovirus system. So this is a grown in insect cells using an insect virus, and you get a large amount of protein produced. But the glycosylation pattern is much simpler in these insect cells compared to mammalian cells. So it's not so appropriate for commercial production. And it's thought the hamster has actually less heterogeneity, which may be an advantage or maybe a disadvantage. Maybe the heterogeneity is there for a purpose, but at least in terms of characterizing your product, it makes it a little easier. So the first thing you want to do is say glycosylate your protein so it looks like the natural thing if you're going to use it. But then you might think about improving on the glycosylation as to what it can do. Maybe you can make a different kind of glycosylation that makes your protein a better binder or a more specific binder, tighter or more specific, or even make a new binding, for example. Or you can influence the antigenicity of your protein. Maybe you don't want the sialic group because that's very antigenic. And so if you can manipulate that, that might be an advantage. Can you alter the and make a different kind of glycosylation pattern that will give you better clearance rate? Or can you decrease the heterogeneity? So all of these are goals that are only starting to be realized, but several companies have been formed based on focusing on glycosylation of proteins as their service or product. So how might you modify this glycosylation? If you have a protein that doesn't have glycosylation, you might want to add it. So can you add just an asparagine, say, to one end, or an asparagine X serine? Would that be enough? Turns out you need longer than that, 10 or 12 amino acids to form a particular site, and you have to locate it on the outside of the protein. And then if you do that, it does get glycosylated. So this is all of this modification, which is number one, is modifying your protein, modifying the glycosylation on your particular protein. But another strategy is to modify the cells that are producing your protein so that they do a wholesale change in the way they're glycosylating all of their proteins, including the one you're going to make. They had a question about whether you can recognize a phenotype from such changes in glycosylation. And the most dramatic phenotype, perhaps, is the one that's used in the lab, is lectin resistance. So lectins are proteins that bind specifically, that bind to specific carbohydrate, complicated carbohydrate groups. And we have them, and plants have them. Most of the work on lectins is done with the plant lectins, because they're used as a reagent. And Pam Stanley was the pioneer in, I think she's still up at Albert Einstein. So, so what she did was look for resistance. I thought I had this here. I guess so. Let me just do this first. She selected for lectin resistance. In other words, cells that weren't producing the specific carbohydrate group that served as the binding site for the lectin. The lectins, for some other reason other than binding, are able to kill the cells. I mean, that's what these plant lectins do. And things like wheat germ agglutinin, concanavalin A, ricin, which has sometimes been used, I don't know if it actually was used, but it was used to kill some spy in England in the 30s. So mostly lectin resistance is due to enzyme deficiency, but it can also give you lectin sensitivity as well. So if you don't add the sugar that's necessary for lectin binding, which is a glycosyl transferase in that long chain, then you grow up. So these were done with CHO cells originally. There's also some work on mouse cells. Somewhat ironically, you can also get lectin sensitivity, that is, by failing to add a certain sugar to the end, then the end of this molecule has a different sugar on it. And previously it was not sensitive to a lectin that binds that sugar, but now that that's on the end and exposed and not tied up with some other sugar, it is able to bind a lectin that it wasn't binding before. So you can get, along with resistance to one lectin, you can get concomitantly sensitivity to another lectin. And so these are useful selective markers in some sense. Right? She did a lot of cell hybridization to show whether you had dominance or resistance, that it was due to enzyme deficiency. And by now, people have now identified the glycosyl transferases, they cloned the genes, and so that you can now manipulate these glycosyl transferases and use them as tools for building better cells. I think this is the same as this earlier one. So some of the things, these are some examples. I'll go into more detail in a minute. So, for instance, if you're growing your, making your protein in hamster cells, they will do a 2-3 sialylation. That is, they'll add it to sugar 2 and 3, whereas humans would do it to sugar 2 and 6 with a different enzyme. And so you can clone the gene, the sialyl transferase, that does the 2-6 addition of sialic acid, and you put in your substrate protein that in humans does have a 2-6 sialization, and this was done in Weber hamster kidney cells, and now instead of just the hamster cells, instead of doing just 2-3, they're doing 2-3 and 2-6, so they're getting substantial amount of 2-6 as well. It's heterogeneous, but the rationale is this will be a more effective protein, that it has a more human-like structure. Here's a case where a lot of work has gone into maximizing the antibodies, the Fc region, maximizing its ability to get involved in antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity. So that's where these natural killer cells are targeting a cell that has the antibody attached to it with the Fc region sticking out. They see that Fc region and with their Fc receptor recognize it, and that activates the killing of the targeted cell. So it's important in cancer, also inflammation. We want to get rid of these cells. So it was noticed that having one of these bisecting N-acetylglucosamines, that this enhanced the binding to the Fc region by this natural killer cell. And that rodent cells that were used did not have this enzyme, whereas a rat myeloma cell does have this. So they cloned the cDNA from the rat that could put on this bisecting N-acetylglucosamine and got it expressed in these CHO cells. And put it in a mini gene in which it was driven by an inducible TET promoter. Oh, there's our picture from Genentech on this Fc receptor. There's the antibody, there's the Fc region in brown here, and here's the natural killer cell binding to it and doing its job. So here they did an assay where they took the targeted cells, which was a neuroblastoma, they added natural killer cells and the antibody. And then this was a TED-off system, so they looked at it without their now transgene in there. It's in there, but without it being expressed because of the high tetracycline and TED-off system, they got a certain amount of cytotoxicity, which then leveled off, and they couldn't get anything more. But if they lowered the tetracycline and got their rat enzyme produced, then they got much more cytotoxicity. Although it's actually only, it's a factor of 3, but that's a lot. It's not like 100, but still, it's effective. Now they have these cells, and they can just use those cells all the time to make their monoclonal antibody. They also noticed that maybe the reason they went to this TET system, and rather just looking at whether they had the gene or didn't have the gene, but wanted to control it, is if they added low TET, they would get. If they added, get even higher, lower TET than up here, and get higher production, like no TET at all, then they actually got less effective killing. And with no TET at all, they got killing that wasn't too much different than the high TET. So the amount of the enzyme seemed to have an optimum. So that's another argument for always putting a TET-inducible or some other way inducible promoter onto enzyme you're using to manipulate the cells. This paper, which I'd like you to read as well, also focused on ADCC, but in a somewhat different way. Here they found, even in this case where they don't have this bisecting N-acetylglucosamine, but they have a core fucose. So we've seen this structure like this before. They found that the core fucose actually interfered with the binding of the Fc to the Fc receptor of the natural killer cells. So they'd like to defucosylate their antibody. So their idea was to make a CHO cell, starting with these DHFR minus cells, so they could have gene amplification in them, and knock out the gene that transfers fucose onto this carbohydrate complex carbohydrate group that's going to be added to the protein. So one trouble is that These are CHO cells are diploid for most loci, so they probably have two genes, and in fact they did. But they undertook then this kind of a Herculean effort. So here's the, say, a wild-type allele for the fucosyl transferase gene. And they put in some homology regions flanking, as well as some lock sites that flanked, these are the long homology regions, that flanked the neoresistance gene, and they're missing, actually, they have exon 1, but they don't have exon 2. So their external piece of DNA does not have exon 2, but it has long regions of homology. So if there's homologous recombination, which they can, and they can select for the transfer of this gene looking for neoresistance, and they put on, a la Capecchi, instead of the HSV thymidine kinase, they put on diphtheria toxin gene. This is going to kill the cell if it's expressed. So that's their suicide gene. So if that gets incorporated through non-homologous recombination that takes place mostly at the ends, then those guys will be killed. And of course, it doesn't work 100%, as you'll see. So they're looking for, the idea is to go in first with the neo and knock out one allele and screen among the neo-resistant lines that are not killed by the diphtheria toxin, and see which ones have knocked out one allele of the gene, and their assay is southern blotting. No, it's going to be PCR. Easier than southern blotting. So they're going to look in this region and see, you know, what size piece they get. You know, or they'll look for, use a primer here in the neo and a primer out here in the target part and see if they get a product, the recombinant product. Then, after they have the single knockout, they'll go in with puromycin and do the double knockout, just like the Manley paper we already discussed. And then they're going to take out, just so they make this cell line, so they figure they're going to sell to the world now, which is going to be enzyme negative and won't have this fucose. This is their plan. They're going to put in Cre enzyme, and that'll pop out because of recombination between the two lock sites specifically, the neo and the puro resistance genes, and so end users can now go in and use those markers to bring in their favorite genes. I guess that's the reason. Exactly say why. So to get this hemizygote to begin with, they selected for this G418 resistance and screened by PCR. They treated 100 million cells. They got 45,000 neo-resistant, G418-resistant colonies. And they tested each one by PCR. So they must have had robots, but they got one. They got 40, and then of the 40, they were like all screwed up, and they had duplications of the target gene, and so they really weren't complete disruptions. But they got one true recombinant. So they took that one, and then they did the second step. This time they treated 1.6 times 10 to the 8th, and they got 70,000, and they screened all 70,000, but this time at least they got 10, not 1. And so they got the double knockouts. And then they removed the drug-resistant gene. 96-well plates, still a lot of 96-well plates. So this is a very nice-looking data that they had. So here's a southern blot of one of their putative double knockouts by PCR, now looking at it this southern blotting. So you can see here's the wild type, right? Gives you a band from both alleles here. Here's the hemizygote, so it's still got one wild type and one with this big insertion in it. And then here's the homozygote, where the other wild type now has the insertion in it again. And the fourth lane is after the Cre treatment. It goes back to something. Should be about 200 bases less than this. No, it should be more than that. It should be about 1 kb less. Doesn't look that much less, but looks a little bit less. anyway, they went on to look at the mRNA, because the mRNA should be missing that exon 2. That's even after all this Cre recombination. Indeed, they see this this difference in size. That's consistent with a 200 base deletion. So now they characterize this cell line. They treat it with another one of these lectins. This lectin is specific for the fucose group. It's a lentil bean lectin. And they fluorescinated it so they could see it in the flow cytometer. And here's a control. I'm going to have to bring over here, which is not just background autofluorescence, but they actually treated it with an unconcerned antibody, an anti-avidin antibody that shouldn't react, so it's a little bit nicer. So they get some background level, and you can see the wild-type cells are like tremendously separated by two orders of magnitude in intensity, these cells, for the fluorescent fucose-binding lectin. And here's their hemizygote, plus and minus, and look at that. It's got less. It's got about half. So this contradicts what I said earlier about you can amplify the protein and get a whole bunch. Of course, it's a little different. And it still gets completely glycosylated. But here it's really the all the glycosylated proteins in the cell that have a fucose in it is what's being detected here. So in the first case, even though you're making 100 times more of your favorite protein, it's still a small percentage of the total protein in the cell, so you may not be saturating anything. So the two are really not inconsistent. But it's almost exactly half. It is exactly half. There's almost too good data. And now they go to their double negative. Now I got my light back. And you have virtually nothing. So it's behaving beautifully. It's just not fucosylated. And if you look by HPLC for these sugars by digesting the total proteins in the cell with various glycosidases that give you these these different forms, so you have all these nine different forms, you see that the ones that contain fucose in them are missing. And the others are still there. And if you go further and digest all the way to monosaccharides, so here's fucose in the wild-type cells, right? And it's not there in this double knockout mutant. So there's no fucose. Now they look at the biological results. One thing they look at is whether their antibody. So the antibody they're using, this is the CD20 one, and the antibody they're using is produced commercially and called Rituxan. It's an anti-CD20. And the binding of the antibody to its antigen, which shouldn't be affected by this change in the Fc region, is in fact not affected. So they're comparing several cell lines here, what they call the FUT8 minus minus, which is their knockout. And there's also a rat cell line that they use, which is over here, which is naturally low in fucosyl transferase. So the second thing they look at is complement-mediated cell toxicity. So this is not ADCC. This is a different kind of toxicity. It is not influenced by the fucose. And indeed, this lysing of cells with complement plus antibody is about the same, whether it's fucose transferase negative or Rituxan, which is they buy, which is produced in a fucosyl transferase positive CHO cell, I assume. Now they look at ADCC assays, so that's cytotoxicity that we saw before, and concentration of antibody to produce a certain amount of cytotoxicity where they mix natural killer cells in with their CD20 target cells. And here's Rituxan, which is pretty poor at this cytotoxicity. And here's the rat cell that is highly deficient, but not zero, in fucosyl transferase. And here's this FUT8-, which is the best. So again, the cytotoxicity is still only like 30%. And the last test they do is whether the Fc receptor can bind or not in the... easy to get this backwards. So the idea was that the way this is working is that the Fc receptor binds better if you don't have the fucose. So if you make the monoclonal antibody in one of these double knockout FUT minus cells, they bind very well, as Rituxan binds pretty poorly. The rat cell is sort of intermediate, but not nearly as good. So in actual binding, the difference between the complete knockout and the rat cell is quite high, whereas the actual killing, it isn't that high. When they analyze it, the rituxan is about 98% fucosylated, and theirs not fucosylated at all. So again, this is a big patent, and it's, I don't know how widespread its adoption is so far, but this is probably the most dramatic genetic engineering in terms of glycosylation that's out there so far. But I've always thought that if one were ambitious, one could knock out, say, all the glycosylation step by step, and then add back the enzymes you want, all under inducible promoters, and produce one cell line that does this, builds this kind of carbohydrate, and other cell lines that builds that kind of carbohydrate, and you could have all these designer cells for carbohydrates. But maybe in another couple of decades we'll see that. Or I guess in order to know what to build, you have to have a reason. Here it was pretty clear what to go for, but in many cases I think the function of these carbohydrates is not so well understood. But when you think about it, that because of its variety, we admire the variety of proteins, all their different amino acid sequences. It can do so many different things by folding into different ways and being able to interact and do their jobs. And now we have, in a way, this added complexity, not just the phosphorylation here or there that's controlling its overall activity, but maybe in more subtle ways. So there may be more information in these proteins added by these carbohydrate groups, and the more we learn about them, the better we kind of products we can make, and the better maybe pathology we can understand. So next time we'll start on building our own antibodies. And